Hello, and welcome to Life Lab. I'm David Ponder.
And I'm Zach Schaefer.
We created a candid podcast for busy people. We get right to the point of our topics, and we keep them to 30 minutes or less.
We wanted to put our ideas out there, share it with people we love, and if it spreads, great.
Our show has no edits and no gimmicks.
Like it or don't, we initially started this project for ourselves, to record our thoughts for our kids, but our friends and family thought we should share it, so here you go.
Hello, and welcome to Life Lab. Today we're going to talk about a very important social topic. It's compassion.
Yeah, it's tied to love. Did we do love last?
I don't know. I don't think we've... Have we done love already?
Yeah.
Oh.
You said it was your favorite episode we've ever done.
Well, we haven't released it yet.
True. We haven't released
it. So, just so everybody knows, I go through and I listen to the podcast that we do. Because I feel like it helps me process, you know, everything that we've said, and it helps me try to enact the things that we say, because it's so easy to think something and not follow through with it.
Yep.
So, and that actually leads to a really good start to the episode. I'd like to start with, like we used to, the definition of compassion, because I think this one justifies that. And I found what I think is a really good one on Berkeley's website. It says that compassion literally means to suffer together. And so it says, among emotion researchers, it's defined as the feeling that arises when you're confronted with another's suffering and you feel motivated to relieve that suffering. So they take it one step further, and I'd like to include this in the beginning. It's not the same as empathy or altruism. Although those things are related, empathy refers more generally to the ability to take the perspective of and feel the emotions of another person. Compassion is that plus when those feelings and thoughts include the desire to help. Altruism is the kind, selfless behavior that's, you know, often prompted by feelings of compassion, but you can be altruistic without having compassion. You can just do altruistic things. So compassion is sort of like empathy plus, feeling and understanding the emotions, desires, struggles, suffering of others, and having that desire to help. At least that's what Berkeley says. I like that definition.
Yeah, I think it's good. I don't agree with it completely. To me, compassion is love in action. If there's no action, for me, it's not compassion. I think pity and sympathy are weak emotions. I think they make it, and I took that from Ayn Rand, the philosopher. I think it just tears us down. It does nothing good. It forces us to focus on things that literally make us feel bad without doing anything about it or helping the other person. So I like their definition, the desire to do it. But for me, I can have all kinds of desires all day, but if I don't express the desire by doing something about it, I'm not exhibiting compassion. I'm thinking about compassion.
Okay.
So I think of it as love in action. To me, it's about translating motivations and desires, like they talk about, into action and doing something.
That makes sense.
I mean, here's the way because I talk about this a lot in class, the difference between sympathy and empathy. I really don't get into compassion, to be honest. Sympathy is when you're driving on a highway and you see a stray dog running by and you go, oh, that dog, oh, it's going to get run over. And then your heart sinks, you get the tightening in your stomach, you might start to sweat a little bit. You're looking back in the rear view as you're driving to wherever you're going, and then the dog gets run over and dies. Empathy is much more putting yourself in that dog's shoes, trying to understand, oh man, what's going on? Compassion is pulling over and helping the dog off the road.
I like it. I don't disagree with any of it. Yeah.
Yeah, so today I did it a little different. This is our first episode, I think, since I've got my new whiteboard wall. So side note, people, if you like whiteboarding and writing things visually, I highly encourage you to check out this special paint called Idea Paint. It's not cheap. It's like $250 for a gallon, but that'll get you a 6-foot by 8-foot stretch of wall, and it turns that whole wall into a whiteboard. So what I did is I created a mind map of the idea of compassion on that whiteboard, and so that's kind of how I'm working from my notes today.
I love it. I love that you have that in your office now. We have that at CET, and we work off of that a lot. So
yeah,
mind maps are great too.
Well, I think that article you pulled up is pretty interesting. Maybe you can mention that. And he's like, you get texts on your computer, right? And I said, yeah. He goes, hey, I'm going to send you something. It's just going to make you feel terrible. I said, well, I don't want to read that before compassion. He's like, no, no, it's tied into compassion. Just read it. So bring up. No, I'm glad you sent it because it's spot on to what we're discussing this morning.
And I think it's spot on to some stuff that's going on in our country right now, unfortunately. Yep. I mean, basically, it's an article. It's in the Scientific American. Anybody can find it if you want. It's titled, How Wealth Reduces Compassion. And the subtitle is, As Riches Grow, Empathy and Compassion for Others Seems to Decline. And it's really, I mean, it's a sad thing. You know, I find myself believing in evolutionary biology more and more. I hear a lot of people who have idealistic reasons why humans are the way they are. But, you know, unfortunately, like Occam's razor, I think sometimes the simplest explanation is always the most likely. And, you know, us evolving as humans and our ability to survive to this point, usually you can find explanations for almost every human behavior or tendency in evolutionary biology. Like, well, that's how we survived as tribes, and that's why, you know, we are what we are. This one, to me, seemed to go against what your gut feeling would be for, as an evolutionary biologist, or at least for me thinking it in that term. You know, you would think that as you became poorer and had less, then you would be less compassionate to others because you would have to shift your attention to yourself, right? So if we're just talking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs and we're talking about scarcity, why the heck, if I'm poor and I don't have enough for myself to eat and be secure, would I have compassion for others? You would think that my compassion level would shrink in and I would have to focus only on myself so that I would allow myself to survive. But it seems to be that that's the opposite, unfortunately. They did some studies in this article where they showed two groups of people, you know, based on economic status, videos of children who have cancer describing, you know, the problems that they're going through. And there was another one that they did.
Showed a video of people talking about how to build a patio.
Yes.
That was the control video.
Yes. And anyway, they had their heart rate monitored. They were offered candy afterwards and told that the remainder of the candy is going to go to children in lab studies. And the wealthier people, I mean, their heart rate slowed less. Your heart rate slowing is a sign of compassion. It's a sign of stopping and listening and paying attention to other people. And then the other thing is the wealthier people took more of the candy and left less for the kids. And they gave some other examples about how this happens. And, man.
Just read that one paragraph.
Okay. It says, just like I said, why would wealth and status decrease our feelings of compassion for others? After all, it seems more likely that having few resources would lead to selfishness. Piff and his colleagues suspect that the answer may have something to do with how wealth and abundance give us a sense of freedom and independence from others. The less we have to rely on others, the less we may care about their feelings. This leads us towards being more self-focused. Another reason has to do with our attitudes toward greed. Like Gordon Gekko, upper-class people may be more likely to endorse the idea that greed is good. Piff and his colleagues found that wealthier people are more likely to agree with statements that greed is justified, beneficial, and morally defensible. All those attitudes ended up predicting participants' likelihood of engaging in unethical behavior. You know, this is, like, we talk about what's going on in our country right now. There is a huge divide. And one of the biggest tricks that I think that's going on right now, and this is a side comment, is that the elite and the wealthy have somehow convinced middle and lower middle class, white people in particular, that they are different from the lowest class people, typically of a different race, and they are more different from them than they are from the elites, and that they need to be protecting themselves against those lowest class of people who are siphoning off of them and breaking our country and taking all the health care and all this stuff. You know, whereas if you looked at a ladder and you compared the rungs that those people are on versus the lowest class people, they're one rung ahead. Yeah. And then on that whole ladder, the elites are at the very top rung.
So how does that tie into compassion then?
It's a psychological trick that they are using this, I believe, what they describe in the Scientific American, to make the middle class people feel as though they are so much wealthier and so much better off than the lowest class of people that they end up basically engaging this psychological tendency in middle and lower middle class people. And then they tend to vote for policies that are best for the elite, the people that are 50 rungs away from them. It's unbelievable, but that's happening in our country right now. The last thing I'll say about this is I just watched a breakdown. CBS did a breakdown of the proposed new Republican tax bill. And, you know, it's very complicated, a lot of things going on. But they asked the economist at the very end, who benefits the most from this bill? And her response was, the elite, the very, very elite are the ones who benefit the most from this tax bill.
Yep. I mean, that makes sense, but I don't want to get into politics. I want to stay focused on compassion. My retort to that would be any bill that's ever introduced is pretty much, if it's tied to money, taxes, it's always going to benefit the elite. The entire system is rigged to benefit the elite.
Yeah, and I think the reason that I wanted to discuss that is income inequality in the U.S. is becoming – it's actually becoming a problem now. And the middle class that made the country so strong, you know, we keep talking about it shrinking, and everyone's like, why? And it seems like there's two schools of thought, right? One is it's because the elite, like what you just said, the elite have the power. They rig the system in their favor. The bills that get passed are for them. But I don't think that that's the general wisdom among the general population. I think the general population thinks, well, it's because we have this burden of this poor population that keeps sucking away our tax money and doing nothing with it. And they're just a burden on our system. I think that and if you want to talk compassion, right, which one of those things you tend to believe on, what you tend to align with, I mean, that might say something about you and your level of compassion.
Mm-hmm. I just hate poor people. Hate them all. Get them all out of the country. If you make less than me, you shouldn't be in the United States of America. There's my compassion.
Well, I mean,
I'm kidding.
I know, but no. What I'm saying is, turn on Fox News.
I don't
want
to talk politics.
Well, turn on certain channels.
I don't want to talk politics. I wanted to talk about compassion and love.
I know.
And now we're getting sucked into the bullshit, fucking crap that we do as humans, and I hate it. I hate it.
But this is compassion, Zach.
Yeah.
The topic is compassion.
I have no
compassion live in
for the people that create these systems. I'll tell you that. There's my hard heart coming out.
Well, you don't have you're just saying you don't have compassion for the people who create the systems, which means you don't have compassion for the elite, which should mean that you're saying that you do align with the lower rungs of that ladder that we were talking about, which would mean you have compassion for the people who need it.
I'm
just talking about, I know, I'm talking about misdirection. That's all I'm saying.
You're talking about politics, which is not what today's topic is.
I'm talking about power structures misdirecting people's compassion. That's all. Or breaking it. So let me use this as a bridge into something else. Because I can tell that you're not happy with this.
I'm not.
Although I think that what I just said there is very important, and I'd like everyone listening to let it sink in and do your own research about it and see what you think about that. And think about it as it relates to compassion. And which side of the spectrum should you be compassionate about? Should you be compassionate about the elites making the bills, or should you be compassionate to the people who are the poorest people who need help?
But now, even right there, in your definition, you are sucking in what they are wanting you to do. You've created a dichotomy as if there's just two groups. We can go so deep on this. It's all bullshit. It's smoke and mirrors. They want us to talk about elite or poor. There's a million ways to differentiate how we are as humans in this planet. And the fact that we then think it must be black or white, either or, rich or poor. It's a joke. Like, create our own categories and ways of talking about and understanding these nuances. To me, even when the and we're, I guess, a little part of the media with this podcast, if we just regurgitate these labels of what the talking heads, whether it's the elite or the media, just doing their little churning out everything and repeating what other people say, we're part of the problem.
Well, that's a fair criticism, but it's neither here nor there when you listen to what I'm trying to get to. And that is, what I'm trying to get to is, I believe that when we were reading the initial definition of compassion, which is to suffer together, our country, our society, our tribe was at its strongest when we had things that we suffered together through. The biggest being the world wars. We were never stronger as a country than right after World War II. And we had just been through this period of, it didn't matter if you were on the elite side or the middle side or any part on that spectrum, because it's not a dichotomy if you want to fight about that. That's not what I'm trying to fight about. What I'm trying to say is we all suffered together. You know, like my grandma tells me a story, told me a story about a year that she got an apple for Christmas, an apple for Christmas. Not an Apple fucking MacBook, an Apple.
Right.
And, but, and, you know, she, and obviously this is her memory and saying things were better back then. But she said, you know, people were more neighborly to each other back then. You could go to your neighbor and borrow a cup of milk, and people typically did that. It was a closer knit community. People relied on each other more. I tend to believe her. I tend to believe her. I do believe that what this article said, which is as we've become wealthier, right, as individuals, as families, it has decreased our reliance on each other. It has decreased our compassion for one another.
No, I agree with that point. But again, since you want to talk about politics, you're talking about it from a nationalistic standpoint. No, you're talking about the United States. So where
it could be anything. It could be a tribe.
The Germans were pretty compassionate to each other while they were exterminating 7 million Jews. Dude, they created an unbelievable culture of love, and everyone's out being strength and this and that while they were doing the worst things in the history of humanity. At the very same time, they had all kinds of compassion for each other.
Well, now we're
talking. Or what about the Japanese? Where was FDR's compassion when he said in his personal journal, "I've tried to do everything in my power to provoke them to attack us so we can go to war with them"?
Well, you're talking about tribalism. And we're talking about human evolutionary biology, right? So that has nothing to do with compassion. Compassion of who, right? Well, obviously, you're going to be compassionate to your tribe, right? And your tribe is going to war with other tribes.
But the point you're making is that you're saying the elites of our tribe, the USA, so to speak, is trying to break itself down to keep them in power. And that's the point that I'm saying. It's always been that way. It will always be that way. This is the tool they're using now. They probably use similar tools in the past. The mechanism might change in the future. It's always going to be whoever has the biggest piece of land, the biggest stick, and the biggest bank account is going to do whatever is possible to convince everyone else that they're wrong and inferior. And that right now they use the media to do that.
And apparently they feel justified in doing so.
100% they do.
So psychologically, they feel like they're more justified because they're doing the right thing.
Well, and they're better. Yeah. If you believe they're better than other people.
Absolutely. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about why is it justifiable to feel less compassion toward groups who are not similar to your own?
Again, that goes back. We can do a whole series on biology, evolutionary biology, tribalism, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, it seems like we're agreeing on that. Like, we got really heated between each other, but it seems like we're agreeing. I don't care if you define it as the United States today, Germany back then, Vikings in their time, how they probably were super compassionate between each other. However, they were, going around raping and pillaging. Right. But it's a human error. I think we are agreeing that there tends to be a proclivity toward being compassionate to your group, your
tribe. People that look like you.
Yeah.
That's it.
Or that you know, or that you
speak your language and look like you.
Right, right.
What about New York? Huh. Where does everyone live in New York? They live in their little Chinatown, Italian town, in their borough. They live in their borough, and then they just walk past each other on the street.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what could break that. So, I would imagine, and this is just a thought exercise, but I would imagine if you took a platoon, an army platoon, who had been in battle together, right? And if they're from the U.S., they're probably a pretty diverse group. They probably don't look anything like each other.
We just saw this in Ken Burns' Vietnam. All these different people from different socioeconomic classes, different races, whatever, different No, it was all men they talked to, but they talked about this, how they bonded together. They weren't fighting for the country. They were fighting to keep each other alive, right? You hear mm-hmm. military veterans talk mm-hmm. a lot about that. Yeah. And they had major compassion for each other because they learned to live together to keep each other alive. Did you watch any of that?
No.
It's powerful.
No, but I want to now. But it goes back to what my grandma said, right? Like when you suffer together, you have tighter bonds.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, what keeps good friends together is getting into and out of trouble together, going yeah. through experiencing trauma together.
Yeah.
That's why another trick that people always use is fear will bring people together. Fear. An enemy, a common enemy is right. a much better way to get a group of people to do something than love.
You know, I read a thing about dating, and it said that couples who did something that was exciting and sort of fearful, like walking across a drawbridge, a high suspended drawbridge together, versus, you know, eating a meal together, they bonded on that first date just by that activity. You know, it's unbelievable, but it's like, how can we think of ways to exploit this evolutionary biology that we have to foster compassion between groups that are disparate in the way that they look and their geographic nature? You know what I mean? I think we all agree we want compassion. This would be a better world if people were feeling empathy for others and taking action on it. Your definition of love in action would change the world, like to its core. But instead, we look at and we have these systems in place that exploit the opposite, right? They make individuals wealthy. They decrease reliance on each other. They, you know, it's crazy because we talk about how we want to reduce suffering, because we do, right? But what if group suffering is a pro-compassion thing and actually generates right. love and action?
I mean, suffering's part of – life is suffering.
It is.
Buddhism teaches us that. Buddhism 101. Life is suffering. Every day we get up and we say, I want this. This needs to happen. I'll be happy when X occurs, and we don't get any of it. That's suffering.
So how do we make folks feel connected to others while they're going through that together?
Again, we clearly approached this on very different levels. Every single note I have up there is about people I know. How do you change the world? You change the world that you live in. You change others' worlds that you come in contact with.
Then let's go that direction.
No, but I'm saying, obviously, you didn't take a bad direction. You took a global perspective and wanted to talk about the systems of
the macro
that we've created yeah. that prevent compassion. And I did not go that way. And that's fine.
Well, maybe that's a thought exercise for the end. Let's start talking about yours, because maybe that's too hard of a problem. And so I think typically the answer to when you say, well, I want to change the world, I want to change the biggest systems, it always starts with yourself. It always starts with
yourself. Who's the most compassionate person you know?
My mom.
Okay. Why?
She lives her life to try to make other people's lives better. I don't know what it is about her. I don't know where she got that. But she couldn't care less. And as a matter of fact, she sometimes dislikes when she receives a physical gift or a nice meal or anything that you would see as someone else, you know, would want. Instead, she literally gets a lift, a boost from giving others, acts of service for others. Love and action.
So to me, the way that you change these big systems you're talking about is to focus on the specific and the concrete of the people in our lives. And then you extrapolate through stepping stones as a way to how can we create structures and systems, patterns of behavior that exemplify the Mary Ponders of the world. To me, that's how you start.
Yeah.
You can't just say, okay, we got to create a new system or structure. Because if so, who's it going to benefit? It's going to benefit all the elites.
Yeah.
Here's a story that is stuck into my head, and this is where I was going to start before we decided to talk politics. It was shared to me by one of my uncles, who's amazing, but I won't say which one, just because it's not necessarily the most flattering story, but it's been a great lesson for me. I was fishing with this particular uncle on a weekend, and we are coming back from Bennett Springs State Park in Missouri, which is a great trout park. They stock it, and we're fly fishing, and he's teaching me how to do all that. A very memorable, great weekend. And we were hungry, and it was a Sunday morning, so we stopped at a Waffle House outside of Rolla, and there was a homeless guy asking for money, begging, right out front of the Waffle House. And I remember we walked in, and I have a spot in my heart for those people, and if I have stuff, I always give it to them. It's just, for whatever reason, it just, I think it's the right thing to do. And we get in there, and my uncle, I was young, didn't have anything to give. My uncle didn't give him anything or really didn't make eye contact with him. And we sat down, and I said, hey, why didn't you help that guy out? And he said, Zachary, people make a series of bad decisions in their lives, and I'm not going to enable him to continue making more of them. That was so fucking powerful at the time. And to me, it's so powerful still, and it's absolutely wrong. It is about hardening your heart. It's about what Dave was talking about at this elite level of, I don't even need to notice this human being because of his or her past actions. Fuck you, is what my uncle was saying to this person, is what I took away.
Yeah.
That is blazoned on my brain. And anytime I see someone that's down and out like that, that's why I have to give.
You and I have had this argument multiple times, and I've never heard that story. That's a powerful story.
It is a powerful story. For me.
You know, I'll give the opposite story, and I'll be the Grinch in the situation. I moved to Denver, Colorado, in 2008, and we lived at 25th and Washington, a place called Five Points. You can watch a South Park episode about the Bloods and the Crips in Five Points. It used to be, it's been gentrified, and I went through and lived through that gentrification, but it used to be a bad place to live. Anyway, the largest homeless shelter in Denver is 6 blocks from where I live, 8 blocks, something like that. It was just far enough that we didn't get too many homeless people outside of our condo where we lived very, very frequently. However, if you went toward that area, and this homeless shelter is in it's in Lodo. It's in lower downtown Denver. It is in, like, as far as real estate property values go, probably one of the highest real estate property areas in Denver. And Denver's gotten very, very expensive. And there's a war going on between these homeless people and the wealthy who live around there. Obviously, you know, because they don't want the homeless people there. If you talk to myself, or you talk to Brad Bender, or you talk to Bart Bennett, we've all experienced this to a point where when you see that on a daily basis and you step out of your car and you're asked for money, you take a walk and you're asked for money, where like on a given day, you can at least be asked, have that experience that you talked about with that homeless person asking you for money one time, but, you know, sometimes 3 times, sometimes 5 times. It does harden your heart because you can't say yes to all of them. You can't give all your money away to them.
Well, no, you could.
You
100% could.
Yeah, you could. You could become
Mother Teresa.
Yeah. Who is the saint that did it? Was it Augustine?
France? I mean, Mother Teresa's a saint. She did it.
Well, okay. So let's say you could give away everything that you owned.
But that's not going to happen.
And join them in their shelter.
And that's what she did.
Right. But if you don't want to do that, if you want to, you know, live the capitalistic lifestyle that we live, and you can't, you make the choice not to, right? And so here's the weird thing is, like, on a very rare occasion, if I were in a good mood, it's a Friday and, you know, like, I'm about to go out to restaurants and bars with friends and whatever. And I'm like, you know what? Screw it. You know, the first thing that comes to your head is, well, they smell like alcohol. It's probably going to use it to get drunk. You know, so no, I'm not going to give you my money. But sometimes I'd be like, you know what? I'm about to go get drunk.
Right,
tonight.
I'm going to use it to get drunk.
Like, here you go, man.
Buy weed.
Here's ten bucks. Go nuts. You know, go get yourself a 12-pack. Have a good time. On the very rare occasion, we would do that. But what I guess the reason I'm telling the story is not because I want to justify it anymore. In the past, Zach and I have argued about this, and I've basically justified it and said, yeah, Zach, that's really great that you're up on your high horse, but if you lived that on a daily basis, you would end up doing what we all ended up doing too, and saying basically what your uncle said. Sorry. Now, that said, I'm not going to take that. I don't want to feel that way. My life is not that anymore, and compassion is, it's a noble thing, and I want to have more of it. So that being said, I guess in that instance, I still think from a practical perspective, if you're not going to live in your life and be a saint, you can't just give money to all of those people. What can you do?
Yeah, there are other things, but that takes effort. That, my point is, people prefer the charity check. It's way easier to just give some money away.
Right.
That's the easiest thing to do, even if you don't have a lot of it, giving somebody a dollar, some change. Oh, I feel better instantly. They might be able to use it for something, whether it's nurturing like food or booze. Fine, go enhance your perceptions for a little bit. It's difficult and different to invite that person into your house and say, do you need a warm shower? Do you need to cut your hair? Do you need a hot meal? I'll cook it for you if you tell me your story, right? Those are things that nobody does.
That's right. That's right. My mind instantly went to, well, you could volunteer at the shelter and help serve the food. You could. A previous employer I worked at had volunteering hours, so it was incentivized to do so, you know. So folks did those things. Habitat for Humanity, X, Y, and Z. I think all of those things are good, but there's something about them that just turns into a social capital. It's inauthentic. Look what I did. Yeah.
So mandating compassion, right, is what you're...
Well, and that's the employer. But even folks who just choose to do it on their own and talk about it, you know what I mean? And put it on their Facebook page, whatever it is that they do. Yeah, it's a form of like social capital. Look at me. Look at what I'm doing for others.
Okay, so then what about my dad?
Yeah, no, your dad's a special case. Your dad's a special case. Well, I mean, Don's a good man.
I mean, he skips my family functions because he has to go feed the needy, as he calls it, on Saturday morning breakfast. Like, literally, he doesn't come to things that me and my family have going on that we invite him to because he feels it's more important to help those people and serve those people. Now, does that bother me? Of course it does. Is he doing the right thing? Yeah, he probably is.
He probably is, yeah.
And he doesn't do it to – obviously, he feels good, but he just believes it's the right thing to do, and he gets to know these people. He helps them out. He goes to their funerals when they die. One guy froze to death in Belleville, and the police – he had my dad's card on him, so the police called my dad. You know, I mean, that to me, that is compassion. And
it is.
And he's got a – he can be, have a real hard heart too at other times, but when it comes to that kind of stuff, helping people that are down and out, helping those that can't defend themselves, whether it's kids or animals – He's probably the most compassionate person I know in general. Then my wife definitely is internally. And I just think of babe. We haven't talked about kids yet, which is weird. We always do. If our kids start crying in the middle of the night, my first initial feeling is very different than Izzy's. Mine is corporal punishment. Right. Mine is duct tape the mouth shut. Right. And I don't do those, but hers is, what's wrong? How can I help you? You know, and I do not have that tendency in my body, period. I have to force myself to do that. She naturally does that. And whether it's all mothers, we could get into that, or I don't know. But she is naturally very compassionate with our kids.
You know what sucks? As I've gotten older, I've lost that. I still have it. Like, and it breaks its way out of me. Quite often now, and I think it's gotten stronger since I've had kids. But that's something I've always had inside.
Yeah, you're natural. You, especially younger, you were very naturally compassionate.
Yeah,
I don't think you've lost it. You know who you are? You're fucking Robin Williams and Peter Pan, brother.
Yes.
You're the guy that's climbing up the corporate ladder. You're running the business. You got all these clients. Go, go, go. My cheese is getting bigger. Oh, yeah, I got kids now. Oh, yeah, there's all this good stuff going on I got to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right.
I mean, it's a really good metaphor from the movie Hook. Yeah. If you haven't seen it, check it out, because people in their 30s who are ambitious and have kids, you are Robin Williams' character.
Man, it's so nuts, you know? Stories do such a good job of reflecting on real life.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's say that. Let's say that that's a conundrum. I think that's a conundrum we all face.
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm outside of it.
Right.
Clearly. But I'm just not as naturally compassionate as you are, though.
Well, and I think we're really hitting a nerve here. Like, I think our audience that is listening right now probably is in our same boat. Or a majority of them, or many of them. I mean, my God, everything that we've talked about, I think everyone has to relate to, right? They have to know people who are naturally compassionate. They have to see this natural compassion in themselves. And they also have to recognize instances where they're putting the better of their insulated group, their immediate family, ahead of compassion for others, the opposite of what you said Don does on a daily basis. Or they are having this instinctual reaction of corporal punishment, like,
right.
Like or at the very least ignore, you know? So I think everyone that has to be listening to us has to relate to the things that we're talking about. And I think we all would agree love in action would change the world for the better.
But then we jump in our head, and whether it's justifying or not, it's thinking through. So sticking with the kids. Okay, showing compassion when something occurs. Claudia falls down and cuts her knee. Right? Not just skins, but like cuts. My initial reaction would be to help, do something, but, you know, stay fairly stoic about it because I need to teach her a lesson about life. To me, this is life. I always say, this is just life, babe. This is what's going to happen. You're going to get knocked down. Life is tough. This is the message I give to my 4-year-old. Right? It works for us. Kizzy's is the opposite. You know, it's very, oh, we're going to get this fixed. But people, probably more men stereotypically, me, in my head I struggle, like, what's the message I want to give? I want to help my child, make sure I overcome and show some love in action, but I need to do it in a way so that when life kicks her in the stomach, which it's gonna over and over and over, she's better prepared.
So
that's the struggle in my head always.
As you're saying that you do that, I'm thinking about what I do. And you know what I do? I go pick up my kids and I hug them. Mm-hmm. And it's so weird because what are you doing in that situation? What am I doing? I think we're projecting our needs onto our children.
Of course.
You say, that's what I needed when I was a kid. And I look at myself knowing that, you know, anyone has read the 5 love languages, physical touch is mine. So I need a hug, man. I need embraced. And as soon as Dylan starts to cry or if Marin falls and skins her knee, but my initial reaction is to go pick them up and hug them and just make them feel loved and safe and, you know. And it's funny because Lauren will be like, don't pick her up.
Yeah.
That's not what she needs right now.
Yeah, exactly. You're just giving in. You're creating a bad pattern of behavior. Yeah. She's going to be needy. She's going to be blah, blah, blah. And that's exactly how I think.
Oh, man.
But to me, there's these fun boundaries. Okay, let's talk about another one. Humor. So we have a fantasy football league, Como Fantasy Football. It's a lot of fun. We're in our, like, 12th or 13th year. It's just one opportunity for a bunch of dudes in their mid-30s to have to talk on a weekly basis and talk trash and have a good time and poke at each other. And we get together and do live drafts every year. So it's just a blast. And so we have a lot of trash talk that goes on. And Dave had a really funny response, and he was going to add a second part to it that would have ribbed at a few guys in our league that maybe aren't as tall as some of the others. And that's an ongoing joke between them. And he then reread it and stepped back and decided not to post that because he felt it was more mean-spirited than funny. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I actually posted it in just a moment of, this is funny. And then I thought over the next 5 minutes about it, talk about that, you know, that compassion that comes out of me from time to time. And I couldn't get over it. I couldn't get over what they would feel like when they read it. And I said, it's not fair. And yeah, the rest of the guys will get a laugh out of it. But is it worth the rest of the guys getting a laugh out of it to make them feel bad about themselves for something they can't control and something they don't deserve? And I was like, no, it's not. You know what I mean? And you know, I don't know, maybe it's the kid thing and me wanting to be a better person in general and not be the, you know, when we, if you look years ago, we used to just get at it in this league. We used to just, nothing was off limits. Oh my God, I'm sure there's records of some of the talking that went back and forth. And it got brutal. You know, nothing was off limits.
Yeah. Wives, girlfriends.
Wives, girlfriends, relationships, things that happened in the past. Yeah. Disagreements you had with other people that aren't even in the league. Everything was brought up and on the table. But it's gotten tamer and tamer and tamer.
Yeah, I think that's a variety of things. Aging, kids.
But I just basically read this and I go, you know what? I love those guys. Those are good guys. I don't need to make them feel bad for no reason whatsoever.
So you nothing actually went back and edited control. It?
I took it out.
Oh, that's cool.
I took the last
one. I didn't know that part. So a few things. One is that all that stuff we've done, did we lose or alter any relationships in a negative way from all that banter we've had over the years?
No.
If
not
nothing,
at all.
It's probably strengthened it probably relationships. Did. Why? Because it's shared trauma.
Yeah.
It's shared suffering. It's safe suffering.
Well, it's almost like when two guys get in a fight. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing that I think I talked with Lauren about, and from the female perspective, to her, it's a conundrum. She doesn't understand it. She recognizes that it's a thing, but as a woman, she doesn't understand it. Men will get in a physical fight. They'll punch each other, like, take it out, and then it'll be over.
And then they're better friends.
And then it'll be over, and they hug.
Better friends.
Yeah, and they're better friends.
Well, the point I was making is tied to Dave's. I love that he did that because it exhibited true compassion. But then I said, there are certain venues where you can push the boundaries, and comedy is one. So, like, if you go see a comic, it's funny because they turn paradoxes and conundrums and contradictions upside down and on their head, and they say things that you could never say in a normal setting, and it's a release. It's cathartic for the human species to laugh at these things we shouldn't laugh at. And I just made the argument that our fantasy football trashed smash talk boards are the same thing. And so, but I think you did the right thing by not doing that. But had you done it, it would have just got a few laughs and no one would have cared.
Yeah, you're probably.
But you did the right thing.
Yeah.
In terms of compassion.
No, you're probably right. And I think there's something about that catharsis that lately it seems like as a society we've become too sensitive and at least we've become sort of social justice warrior-y about stuff. And like you get backlash now when you're being a comedian and you're just trying to bring humor to things.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that – I actually think that there's a place for that. I think that it somehow brings people closer together, like what you were talking about.
Humor?
Well, yeah, the humor and the catharsis of things that are taboo and typically off the
table. Here's the face people make when you make an uncompassionate joke. Oh, no, it's too soon, right? That's it. That's saying something completely not compassionate that's taboo and shouldn't be said, but it's in this safe setting, and it's okay because it's a joke.
And it's a shared understanding.
Yes.
I think it goes back to when you talk about compassion, like the shared suffering component of it, right? So even though one person is the one who introduced the idea and maybe introduced it in a irreverent way, the entire group, you know, bonds over that idea and the reaction to it. So let's talk about
I got a lot of other topics.
Okay,
No, you go ahead. I'm just saying I want to make sure we keep going. We're only 42 minutes in.
This I love this topic.
I think people are going to like it because I got upset, man. I didn't want to talk about politics.
I could tell.
I wouldn't make an eye contact with them. I'm looking out the window.
But I wanted to stay on my ground and basically say that stuff it's the macro, but dude, it's compassion.
Yeah.
It's freaking compassion. Yeah. If we're going to talk about compassion, you can't say, well, I want to talk about these instances of compassion and not this. So anyway, I don't know. I don't have a next step.
Where are you going? Well, I got a lot of stuff up there. So I just posted this comedian. I'd never heard of him, but he gave a commencement speech at some college and he had 9 life lessons. And it's pretty funny. If you got 5 or 6 minutes, you should check it out on my Facebook page. One of his lessons was respecting those with less power than you. And I'll share another anecdote from my life. A very good friend of ours that we met in life. I won't say where because I don't want to isolate this person. But this is a very intelligent person. This is a person with a PhD. This is a person who grew up upper middle class. Had a nice life, works very hard, you know, has a couple kids now, this and that. And I was friends with both of these people, but I'm focused, the story's about the woman, and I was better friends with their husband. And her husband shared a story with me about her, is that whenever they have workers over to their house of any kind to fix something, he's like, it really bothers me how my wife treats them. She treats them like less than servant. First of all, like they're our servants, but then like with this hastiness and rudeness. He's like, it makes me feel bad to where I'm apologizing to these guys and I'm giving them tips without her knowing. And he's like, it makes me really uncomfortable. And that's always stuck with me because I'm the opposite. Anyone that comes to my house to do any kind of work, any kind of bloop, if you work with your hands, you are always getting a tip, a lunch, gift cards to the Post Sports Bar. You're getting something. I'm talking to you. I'm asking questions. I respect you.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. Probably because I grew up in blue-collar family. But then coupled with that story, and then when this guy said, this is one of the life lessons, respect people who have less power than you, that's powerful, in my opinion. It's compassion. It's acknowledging and saying, hey, we might not be equally in terms of our bank accounts or education or how big our houses are, but you're a human being, and if you're around me, I'll talk to you.
Well, it says I'm going to respect you, and I'm going to treat you well with no expectation of reciprocity at all.
You don't need to do anything for me. Yeah.
That is rare.
Yes.
Why has that become rare? God.
Well, I think it goes back to what you were talking about with kind of the elites and who we surround ourselves with. If you're a powerful person, you surround yourself with other powerful people.
Everybody's
lack of noticing.
Oh, and it's I'll scratch your back here, and I'll expect that when I'm in a bind later, you're going to scratch my back. It's like everything that we do is with self-interest in mind. Yeah. You know what I mean? Oh, did you send that gift to so-and-so? You know, I love James Altucher as a writer. One of his articles that came out was giving gifts to people who are in these positions of power because they'll never forget it. And the more unique the gift is, you know, it'll be sitting on their,
desk.
And they'll see it in these moments where you're asking them for something and then you've got the in, right? Okay, great. Great strategy. Great business strategy. When I read the article, I wasn't thinking compassion. I was in a completely different mindset. I was thinking, well, shit, yeah. I send emails. They hit delete instantly. A gift would be a step up. Brilliant. Way to go, James, you know? But when you think about that so much, when our society, our capitalistic society is what you said, I'm growing a business. I'm climbing the corporate ladder. This is me. That becomes your mindset, and it pushes out the guy who's behind you fixing the, your plumbing,
my toilet,
your anything. Like, you literally, it's background fodder. It's just some guy making a problem go away that, you know, I'm paying him for it anyway. So just do it quickly. And as long as I don't have to be bothered by you, the less I'm bothered by you, the better. Like, just get it done. Man, you know, that's interesting. So my dad, whenever anyone came over, he made them a meal, or he would encourage them to
force them
to eat some, force them.
He would say, sit down, son. You're hungry.
Don't be shy.
You're hungry. Don't be shy.
Of course, you know, like most kids who came over, they didn't want to impose or whatever the thing.
But you're
was.
Saying your dad hired child labor to fix things around the house?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying anybody who came over, my dad was he practiced what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, he did.
And so as a natural extension, I feel the need to do that whenever we have anyone come over who's fixing something, painting something, whatever. But I don't take it that extra step, and here's why. Time. Oh, and this sucks. Time is the most valuable thing. I'm paying them money, right? I want to show compassion. So you know what I say to them, and I'm just being self-reflective here. Hey, anything in our fridge, that is yours. If you want a drink, you want a sandwich, you want whatever, it's yours. Also, that pantry next to it, treat it like it's your own, right? While you're here, mi casa es su casa, all right? I'm going to go upstairs. I'm going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I say that, it's not like I sit there for hours and talk to these people. They got a job to do too. But even just that small thing, that's more than they get from the average person.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Good point.
And then when you do give them a gift, whether it's a tip, a drink, a sandwich, a gift card somewhere, they're just blown away. They're always blown away.
They are. They are.
It's interesting to me. Okay, so we're talking compassion. We've been talking a lot about human compassion. There's some study out there. I haven't looked it up, so I haven't looked at the primary research article, so I can't say if this is even true or not, but I heard it on the radio, the idiot DJs, a new study's out. Blah, 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 blah. The study is about whether people are more compassionate towards other humans or dogs, and the study found that we're more compassionate towards dogs.
I believe it.
Again, I haven't verified this, so I'm not saying this is true. So let's just take it as a thought experiment and talk a little bit about that. Are we more compassionate as a species toward other species? And then if so, why not all species?
Yeah.
Because we'll smash a fly, we'll kill a bug, we'll kill an insect, like, without a thought.
You know, there's a...
So is it the size of the species?
No, it's personification.
Mm-hmm.
It's the traits that they have in common with us. It's there's some study that says if something has a face that resembles our face, we become more sympathetic, empathetic, compassionate toward it. It's why we personify inanimate objects in cartoons and kids love them. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it's the talking train. He's got a face, a human face. I love him. I love that that train. So I think there's something about that. And it's crazy because dogs, it's interesting. I just read a thing that I never knew. Dogs all started out as wolves.
Mm-hmm.
Wolves are incapable of being domesticated. Literally, you can take a wolf in your home, and some people do this. They're idiots.
My uncle in Arkansas, his neighbor has a wolf.
And they think that you can have a wolf as a pet and it will be okay. And then they get surprised when the wolf gets bigger and it exhibits pack behavior and aggression and all the things that wolves do. It's not a lovey dog. It doesn't love humans. It wants to be with the other wolves in a pack hunting and killing other mammals. So wolves are different from dogs, but this talks about how quickly dogs evolved from wolves in a short series of generations. And the way that it happened was these wolves started hanging around the periphery of where humans lived and basically eating the scraps that the humans were leaving behind. And that allowed them to get closer to the humans and then the humans to interact with them more. And next thing you know, they're domesticated. They're not wolves anymore over a series of generations. And the old, the dog is a man's best friend thing, right? So it's almost like when you look at a dog, they've got the characteristics that we like. They're warm. They want attention. They want to give you
hugs.
They
give attention.
They give. And what do they ask for? Food. Really? That's about it. You know? They're not the neediest things on the planet like other people are. And they don't have an agenda.
Right.
They'll never tell you that you're wrong. They will never yell at you. They will never judge you or scold you. Right? Like, I can see why people would be more compassionate to a dog.
Yeah, I just found it interesting. But not just dogs.
But not a spider.
Just other animals.
Stomp on spiders all day
long.
Yeah,
we just see no value or worth in those. But I don't. I don't do that.
No, I'm joking. I
but most people will.
Right, right. It's funny. My mom is the one. She'll try to save any bug that's in the house. Like, doesn't matter. This thing could have red eyes and be like 8 inches big. And she'll be like, oh, it's scary, but.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and get them out of the house.
We do the same thing. And Claudia now, she won't kill bugs. She's already internalized that lesson.
That's
so we
awesome.
Take bugs out. Now, the one, I don't want to act like that's a 100% fact. The only time I'll kill one is if it's a – recently we had a big wolf spider. I mean, like, big. It was nasty looking. I'm laying on the carpeting in my family room there, and it was like a Jedi shit. There's no way I could have seen it, but I kind of just looked back, and this sucker is just rolling. I've jumped up, and I'm not scared of spiders anymore. Used to be. But he was nasty looking, and my kids were right there on the floor, and instincts. Like, I had to. I know he's not going to bite him or hurt him, but I
too
killed
close
it.
For comfort.
And then the first thing Claudia said is, Dad, why did you just kill that spider?
I love that.
So I like the fact that she's got that lesson.
That's good. See, I classify him. Mosquitoes, you're dead instantly.
Yeah, me too.
Flies, gnats, dead instantly.
Yeah, I agree.
Those centipede-looking gross things, dead, you know? Spiders, you kill all those other bugs.
Yeah, exactly.
And
I take them outside.
I want to keep you around, you know? Like, you deserve your place.
So we just watched Men in Black yesterday. Great movie. Another excellent metaphor for our spot in the universe. When is it going to be that another species is going to come to our planet and view us like the ants? Not even view us how the movies make it out, like they're going to try to interact. We don't try to interact or understand an ant. We just kill the ant and move on.
What?
We are the ants to some other species out there.
I saw a physicist offering an explanation for why we have not been visited publicly or whatever by aliens. And his thing was, well, what if we're just not that interesting to them?
Mm.
And my first thought was, well, that's just a convenient way to explain that there's no aliens. And then I thought, well, no, wait a minute. That actually really makes a lot of sense. If the universe is a huge thing and it takes time and effort and energy to get from one part of it to another, and, you know, you look out your window and you can see that there's a freaking ant, you know, on a fence over there, or even a colony of them. Like, what the hell do you care?
To me, that says more about that there's enough abundant resources out there that they don't need to come to Earth to use ours. Because while we are uninteresting and kill ourselves and we're ridiculous,
that makes sense.
We do have good resources here because we have consciousness and all these forms of life. So I just think
there's probably enough resources out there. There's enough
resources out there that they don't need to mess with ours right now.
Makes sense.
What about this quote? We're talking about movies. To me, compassion's about noticing the good and exhibiting the good, right? What's good? What's right? But there's plenty of people who notice only the bad and have mean world syndrome and who project the bad and point out the bad and are cynical. I think the older we get two cynical gas pedals. So then we're just floored to them. Oh, this is how life is.
Yeah. You fell down, Claudia.
This right. Exactly. Exactly. It's terrible. It's a terrible message, but it's the one she gets. The quote from Daniel Day-Lewis's character in There Will Be Blood.
Which quote?
There's a bunch of ones that I identify with, and this tells you what it says about me and what I think about people. The one quote, though, is where he says, when I look at people, all I can see is the bad in them. Man, I wish that I wasn't that way, but Dave knows that I probably am. One of my strengths that you filled out was he can immediately size someone up and see their weaknesses. You said that about me as a strength of mine.
Well, I mean, in a business perspective, in a getting things done perspective.
I know, but it's terrible. And it's naturally, and I know where it comes from. I don't need to go there. But it's true. I naturally will look at someone and I notice nothing that's good about them. I only see all their flaws, but then I shift quickly and I don't necessarily act on that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that is how my brain operates.
You've done it so because it's a strategic thing that allows you to have a one-up so that you have a little bit more power in whatever the conflict that's going to arise is going to be.
Even if it's just my perception that it gives me power, right? Oh. It makes me feel good if it's real or not.
But you know what it goes into? It goes into our tendency to say, I'm going to do a better job of helping more people later by not helping this person now.
Yeah.
I say that to myself all the time, right? So, and I actually even have like a hierarchy, a compassion hierarchy. It's like Dylan and Marin. And Lauren, you're number one, you know, and that extends to my extended family and you. And then everyone else, you know, depending on proximity to me, what I like about you, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like the preferences, those internal biases that we all have, then you guys are somewhere on that spectrum of next to last, right? And so right now, I'm not even going to help anybody outside of that internal circle because I need to build up my sphere of influence. I need to build up my sphere of power, my sphere of resources.
Your wealth, your my net wealth. Worth.
Because only then would I then really be able to help those people.
Right. That goes back to the life's just passing us by, you know, and we're not taking the time to do the things we want to do in the future now.
It's living my individual life as corporations live their corporate lives. What is the only thing that matters to a corporation? Next quarter's financial statement. Because that's what our bonuses are based on. That's what our future strategy will, you know, be aligned to. That's what will, you know, allow us to grow and achieve these corporate objectives that we've defined. And so, you know, I don't care that, you know, some people are going to be hurt by it. I need that next quarter number to be X, and so I'm going to...
Let me give you a good example. The Post. We, some of our same store numbers have been sluggish lately, so we've been creating a lot of new programs and marketing ideas to get them going in the other direction, and they have been starting to go great again. But one of the things we're doing is we've created these monthly open bar parties where we'll sell tickets online. We also sell them at the door. If you get them online, they're discounted. It's a buffet, all you can drink, blah, 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 with a cool theme each month, though. Well, we have a very successful Christmas party that we've had for years where we open later on Christmas, and it's packed, dude. People love it. The employees enjoy it. But we have always been closed on Thanksgiving. Well, this year we're opening on Thanksgiving from 3 to whatever for this open bar Thanksgiving party. And we're serving a traditional Thanksgiving meal, which is kind of neat. Anyway, we get a really thoughtful email from one of our managers at one of our locations. And it was 4 or 5 paragraphs expressing that this is wrong. I can't go be with my family on Thanksgiving. If I have to do this, you said you guys would ask for volunteers. Of course, not one of my bartenders wanted to be up here, so it's me now. She said, I think the whole leadership team should have to skip their Thanksgiving with their family, and it would at least show unity.
That's right.
Yes, it is. And the founder of our company, I responded and just thanked her and said, well, we're going to talk about this as a team. And I appreciate you sharing your thoughts. It had to be very difficult. And then she said, it was. I didn't send this for a couple of days. And anyway, the founder responded very thoughtfully because he's a compassionate person himself. And he's going to be at the event the whole time himself. So, you know, but at the end of the day, he's like, we're doing this. The numbers need it. We need it. And so it ties into exactly what you were talking about, because this person and our whole leadership team are compassionate. We care about our people. We know all of our employees. But sometimes you make these decisions based in the structures we live in.
And it's such a – and it's to such a – you know, it's a real –
that's
you
real.
You just experienced
yes.
it. That is actually
when I read her line saying at 3 o'clock is when my family was going to eat and now I'm going to be at work – I thought, because we're hosting. We always host. We love it. I love the holidays. I dress up. I just bought a pilgrim outfit that I'm going to wear every year. I literally was just like, I would rather quit the post than miss that. I am not missing that. No way. So I had major compassionate moment with that person.
I feel the same way. But it's so funny how that compassion dies in the face of – I mean, just think about what is the mission of the post? What is the mission of a company, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not for people, then what is it for? Like, people are the number one thing. Everyone talks to me about Colorado. Oh, you used to live in Colorado. Why'd you move back to St. Louis? Why would you ever do that? Colorado's the best. It's beautiful, blah, blah, blah. You know, that was a dumb decision. And I say, no, man. Like, life's about people. Yeah. Like, because to me, it rings true. I was in... And I've told the story. I can go out and be in the middle of these beautiful mountains by myself and look around, and I just want you to be there with me.
Right.
I just want my brother to be there with
but
me.
But it's which people when you're talking about a company. So who with this decision are we focusing on? We're focusing on, well—
Yourselves and investors.
The line would be to provide a great experience for our guests.
Of course. Right? That's what you're going to say.
Right? Yeah. But it's investors.
It's investors.
And anybody that has equity in the company won. Mm-hmm. And then it is guests because it's going to be a fun party, I'm sure. It will be good.
And
but
that's
my point is most companies put their employees last. The best companies do put their customers, clients, guests, whatever you call them in your industry, they should be first, and you should run your business based on their decisions because that's, you know, it's going to help you or hurt you. You're going to learn from them. Number two should be your employees.
Customers should be first. Employees yes. should be second. Investors should come after that.
Yeah, but it's not that way.
It isn't that way. It used to be that way. There's a really great – I'm going to find this podcast and put it in the episode notes. There was a – it was an excellent podcast. I believe it was the Things You Should Know podcast, but I'm not positive about it. It talked about the history of labor in the United States, the rise and fall of unions, and the way that companies used to treat their employees versus the way that they treat them today.
Right.
Just to give some brief points about it, because this is so important, it is a timeline of the decline of compassion in U.S. corporate culture. It's funny because it ties it back to the end of World War II. It actually goes back to the factories. So originally, during the Industrial Revolution, factories were flourishing. Humans were just cogs in the factory machine. People were losing limbs all the time. Companies didn't care. That's when people said, we have to have unions. We have to prevent this. We can't work 16-hour days. We need, you know, safety. We need all this stuff.
I mean, back then, the coal mines were charging. You had to buy everything at the coal mine company store, mm-hmm. which was more expensive than what you earned. So you were in debt to them. So you worked for them forever. You were a slave. So it started off from a bad place. Then World War II happened. Our country started to flourish and have this abundance. Unions rose, and so workers joined together and started to have power. And then certain companies decided that they wanted to compete with the other companies that had strong unions and good labor practices. They wanted to compete with them without even having unions. And the one that they used was Kodak. Kodak built a town for its employees. They had a theater. They had free babysitting. They had company events. People that worked for Kodak during these decades of time were part of the family, part of the Kodak family, and they all treated each other as such. And the leaders treated their employees as
they respected the people with less power.
Yes, and they chose to do so. They just valued their people. I don't know what it was. It was just a different time. Then it talked about how unions became too powerful. Corruption started to happen. Companies were losing at the losing end of the unions. There was resentment building. And then they talked about this guy. I don't know who he is. I should know. But in the 80s, he was the head cutter. He's the one who would come into these banks and just lay everyone off. And he became known as like the Grim Reaper or something of the time, and it basically said that was the shift. Like once that became acceptable, companies just laying everyone off, then every company saw that was a path to quote unquote success,
to make
financial success, and then now here we are today, and today it keeps evolving because now you're getting the backlash from the employees
right. Who
have no loyalty to the companies. The average tenure at a company, at least according to this podcast, it's under 2 years now.
Oh yeah, they're stepping stones.
It's like 1.3 years is the average tenure at a company now. Just so anyway.
Yeah, to me here, you said you like Occam's razor, so this is the simplest way to say it. Companies get the unions they deserve.
That makes sense.
The union ain't going to be there if you're treating people correctly and right and respecting people with less power and trying to create an environment where you can make a livelihood in a happy way, so to speak, right? And find meaning and purpose in your work and sustain yourself in a sense of security. But when that's not occurring, that's when unions are going to pop up and you get the type of union you deserve.
Well, and to tie it back to compassion, you hit the nail on the head when I said people are the number one, right? That's what life should be about. That's what companies should be about. But then you hit the nail on the head when you said, yeah, but which people?
Right.
And then we came full circle to what we were saying at the very beginning that you weren't liking, which is like our tribe,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
Who's your tribe? Who is it that you tend and lead to be compassionate towards? And who? So let's talk change challenges. Is this a good time?
Yeah, I think we're ready to roll. Go ahead.
I think we would agree that being compassionate is an important thing. So that's
number one. An important thing.
Yes.
Okay.
So number one, we should be compassionate. I would think an easy change challenge is be compassionate. Some change challenge that would say be compassionate to the people you are closest to. But I think that's an easy thing. I don't think that's a stretch goal.
It's not, but let's make it more concrete. Break out of your whatever pattern it is. So, Zach, here's mine. The next time something happens with Claudia, I will not try to teach her how the world works lesson. I will hug and show love like Dave would. That'll be my change challenge. And I'll report to you when I do that.
I like that change challenge. I think the next thing would be, let's be compassionate to someone who it's hard to be compassionate to. Who is someone who is not in our tribe? Who is someone that is outside? And how do we do that? How do you get your uncle to care about that guy at Waffle House?
Okay, here's an interesting – oh, wow. So we're going to come full circle. So the same uncle – again, I could say the name, but some people might take these the bad way. That lesson taught me a very important lesson. Him saying that to me has made me treat many, many humans in the right way. So if anything, it was a great lesson I took. And he didn't – I think I've shared it with him. Anyway – This same uncle recently was over at my mom's. We were celebrating her 63rd birthday. And at the time, I had Roderick with me, who's was my former little brother, big brother, big sister. He's aged out of the program. He's 20 years old, but we kind of just – we still hang out and talk a lot. So he spent the night at my house that whole weekend, and he just hung with me and, you know, came over to my mom's for dinner that night. Well, this uncle came, and he had known all about Roderick through Facebook and met Roderick, this and that. And this uncle loves to just he's goofy, he's sarcastic, we pick at each other all the time. And the first thing he's like, "Roderick, great to meet you. You go by Red, don't you?" And he's like, "Yeah." He's like, "I do too. That's what my nickname was growing up. That's a great nickname." He's like, "How are you still hanging around with this guy? I would have shot this son of a bitch years ago if I was you," you know, kind of kidding around. And Roderick just starts laughing, and Josh and my brother jumps in. I get a call from my uncle the next morning. That was Sunday, so Monday morning. And he leaves me a 45-second message. "Zachary, I am so sorry for what I said to your little brother. I cannot believe that I said, 'Have you shot that person?' Not thinking about the community that he's from and the experiences that he's seen." I mean, it was heartfelt. Like, I'm tearing up thinking about this message. And so I called my Uncle Pat. I'm just like, "Dude, that's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard you say. A, B, he didn't even, you know, like, think twice about it." But to me, he shows compassion. We all have compassion, but we build up our hardened hearts and we don't want to expose our vulnerability. But in that moment, he thought about this for 24 hours and then he's like, "I want his number. Give me his number so I can call him." And I said, "Much appreciated, unnecessary, because there's no issue." I just think it's a good circle.
No, I love
going back to what you're talking about.
I love that circle. I mean, I have another example where an Uber driver I was with was complaining that she had a flat tire and nobody pulled over to help her. And the first thing that goes through my mind is, well, yeah, they don't know who you are. You know, they don't want to get robbed by the people who you're with who are hiding in the woods by the road. You know, like, and that's become society's hardened heart. You know.
Yep.
So. And that's our justification for not being compassionate. So then,
security, safety,
and and any number of other things. But yeah, I think we kind of use that as a ruse sometimes.
Oh yeah,
because there could be a million people with flat tires that are getting help on the side of the road. You know, statistically, 0.0001% of them would take advantage of the person who's helping them. But that's the one that would make the news.
Right.
That's the one that everyone would say,
"They'll shove down your throat.
That's why you can't help people.
Watch Channel 5. We'll keep you safe when your tires are flat."
Yeah. Do not help other people. Watch Channel 5. Okay. So that being said, what would be a good change challenge that's going to force? How about this? Be compassionate in a situation where you feel uncomfortable.
I like about that. It. That's good. Because when you said it earlier, I started thinking going to the one person that's your sort of enemy, so to speak, and that might be a little too hard, adding in more steps. No. So you just hit it. Repeat it again because I think it's important.
Next time you find yourself feeling an ethical compassion conundrum, you notice someone who is in need that you could help, and you can help them or not. The dog on the road that you're seeing in the rearview mirror, so to speak. Change that sympathy to compassion, even if it's uncomfortable. As a matter of fact, do it in a situation where it is uncomfortable.
I like that. Okay. Mine is converse with the help. When you have somebody come over to help you out, to fix something that you can't, and you know they're more blue collar, converse with blue collar people. Respect people with less power than you. It just goes a long way in being human. Lastly, I would say is just find way to share your vulnerability with others. And that's a more of an abstract one. Dave's clearly hits on that as well. But just it's okay to be vulnerable sometimes. And my uncle, you know, he did an unbelievable job at being vulnerable and thinking about his language and his comment. And it was unnecessary, but it was a second great lesson that he taught me that you can teach an old dog new tricks. Or maybe the old dog knows those tricks, but just chooses not to show people those tricks.
Well, and you can rip that layer off a hardened heart sometimes, yep. Right?
Nice. Well, that's what we got. We went a bit longer on this one. Hopefully you enjoyed our arguments, but we came back full circle. And as we always like to say at Life Lab, experiment with life.
Experiment with life.